I have not been forestalled. I have been betrayed. My officers have been tampered with, and against all history and rationality, they have refused to fight for a woman, but only for their old master. And, traitors as they are, they then let their old master be seized so that he cannot lead them in resistance. She looked about for a chair and sat down. And now the empire must continue to decay and die when I was prepared to offer it new life. I think, said Doris, the empire has avoided an indefinite period of useless fighting and destruction. Console yourself with that, Madam Mayor. It was as though Rachel did not hear her. So many years of preparation destroyed in a night. She sat there beaten, defeated, and seemed to have aged 20 years. Doris said, It could scarcely have been done in a night. The suborning of your officers, if that took place, must have taken time. At that, Demerzel is a master, and quite obviously I underestimated him. How he did it, I don't know. Threats, bribes, smooth and specious argument. He is a master at the art of stealth and betrayal. I should have known. She went on after a pause. If this was outright force on his part, I would have had no trouble destroying anything he sent against us. Who would think that Y would be betrayed, that an oath of allegiance would be so lightly thrown aside? Selden said with automatic rationality, But I imagine the oath was made not to you, but to your father. Nonsense, said Rachel vigorously. When my father gave me the mayoral office, as he was legally entitled to do, he automatically passed on to me any oaths of allegiance made to him. There is ample precedence for this. It is customary to have the oath repeated to the new ruler, but that is a ceremony only, and not a legal requirement. My officers know that, though they choose to forget. They use my womanhood as an excuse, because they quake in fear of imperial vengeance that would never have come had they been staunch, or tremble with greed for promised rewards they will surely never get, if I know Demerzel. She turned sharply toward Selden. He wants you, you know. Demerzel struck at us for you. Selden started. Why me? Don't be a fool. For the same reason I wanted you. To use you as a tool, of course. She sighed. At least I am not utterly betrayed. There are still loyal soldiers to be found. Sergeant? Sergeant Immerthalis entered with a soft, cautious step that seemed incongruous, considering his size. His uniform was spruce, his long blonde mustache fiercely curled.
Madam Mayor,
he said, drawing himself to attention with a snap. He was still, in appearance, the side of beef that Harry had named him, a man still following orders blindly, totally oblivious to the new and changed state of affairs. Rachel smiled sadly at Rach. And how are you, little Rach? I had meant to make something of you. It seems now I won't be able to.
Hello, Mrs. Madam, said Rach awkwardly.
And to have made something of you too, Dr. Selden, said Rachel. And there also I must crave pardon. I cannot. For me, madam, you need have no regrets. But I do. I cannot very well let Demerzel have you. That would be one victory too many for him, and at least I can stop that. I would not work for him, madam, I assure you, any more than I would have worked for you. It is not a matter of work. It is a matter of being used. Farewell, Dr. Selden. Sergeant, blast him. The sergeant drew his blaster at once, and Doris, with a loud cry, lunged forward. But Selden reached out for her and caught her by the elbow. He hung on desperately. "Stay back, Doris," he shouted, "or he'll kill you. He won't kill me. You too, Rach, stand back. Don't move." Selden faced the sergeant. "You hesitate, sergeant, because you know you cannot shoot. I might have killed you 10 days ago, but I did not. And you gave me your word of honor at that time that you would protect me." "What are you waiting for?" snapped Rushell. "I said shoot him down, sergeant." Selden said nothing more. He stood there while the sergeant, eyes bulging, held his blaster steady and pointed at Selden's head. "You have your order," shrieked Rushell. "I have your word," said Selden quietly. And Sergeant Thallus said in a choked tone,
"Dishonored, either way."
His hand fell, and his blaster clanged to the floor. Rushell cried out, "Then you too betray me." Before Selden could move or Doris free herself from his grip, Rushell seized the blaster, turned it on the sergeant, and closed contact. Selden had never seen anyone blasted before. Somehow, from the name of the weapon, perhaps, he had expected a loud noise, an explosion of flesh and blood. This Wyan blaster, at least, did nothing of the sort. What mangling it did to the organs inside the sergeant's chest, Selden could not tell. But without a change in expression, without a wince of pain, the sergeant crumbled and fell, dead beyond any doubt or any hope. And Rushell turned the blaster on Selden with a firmness that put to rest any hope for his own life beyond the next second. It was Rach, however, who jumped into action the moment the sergeant fell. Racing between Selden and Rushell, he waved his hands wildly.
"Mrs. Mrs.," he called. "Don't shoot."
"Mrs. Mrs.," he called. "Don't shoot." For a moment, Rushell looked confused. "Out of the way, Rach. I don't want to hurt you." That moment of hesitation was all Doris needed. Breaking loose violently, she plunged toward Rushell with a long, low dive. Rushell went down with a cry, and the blaster hit the ground a second time. Rach retrieved it. Selden, with a deep and shuddering breath, said, "Rach, give that to me." But Rach backed away.
"You ain't gonna kill her, are you, Mr. Selden? She was nice to me."
"I won't kill anyone, Rach," said Selden. "She killed the sergeant and would have killed me, but she didn't shoot rather than hurt you, and we'll let her live for that." It was Selden who now sat down, the blaster held loosely in his hand, while Doris removed the neuronic whip from the dead sergeant's other holster. A new voice rang out. "I'll take care of her now, Selden." Selden looked up and in sudden joy said, "Hummin, finally." "I'm sorry it took so long, Selden. I had a lot to do. How are you, Dr. Vanevoli? I take it this is Manick's daughter, Rushell. But who is the boy?" "Rach is a young Dalite friend of ours," said Selden. Soldiers were entering, and at a small gesture from Hummin, they lifted Rushell respectfully. Doris, able to suspend her intense surveillance of the other woman, brushed at her clothes with her hands and smoothed her blouse. Selden suddenly realized that he was still in his bathrobe. Rushell, shaking herself loose from the soldiers with contempt, pointed to Hummin and said to Selden, "Who is this?" Selden said, "It is Cheddar Hummin, a friend of mine, and my protector on this planet." "Your protector?" Rushell laughed madly. "You fool! You idiot! That man is Demerzel, and if you look at your Vanevoli woman, you will see from her face that she is perfectly aware of that. You have been trapped all along, far worse than ever you were with me. Hummin and Selden sat at lunch that day, quite alone, a pall of quiet between them for the most part. It was toward the end of the meal that Selden stirred and said in a lively voice, "Well, sir, how do I address you? I think of you as Cheddar Hummin still, but even if I accept you in your other persona, I surely cannot address you as Ato Demerzel. In that capacity, you have a title, and I don't know the proper usage. Instruct me." The other said gravely, "Call me Hummin, if you don't mind, or Cheddar. Yes, I am Ato Demerzel, but with respect to you, I am Hummin. As a matter of fact, the two are not distinct. I told you that the Empire is decaying and failing. I believe that to be true in both my capacities. I told you that I wanted psychohistory as a way of preventing that decay and failure, or of bringing about a renewal and reinvigoration if the decay and failure must run its course. I believe that in both my capacities, too. But you had me in your grip. I presume you were in the vicinity when I had my meeting with His Imperial Majesty." "With Cleon? Yes, of course." "And you might have spoken to me then, exactly as you later did as Hummin." "And accomplished what?" "As Demerzel, I have enormous tasks. I have to handle Cleon, a well-meaning but not very capable ruler, and prevent him, insofar as I can, from making mistakes. I have to do my bit in governing Trentor and the Empire, too. And, as you see, I had to spend a great deal of time in preventing Wai from doing harm." "Yes, I know," murmured Selden. "It wasn't easy, and I nearly lost out. I have spent years sparring carefully with Mannix, learning to understand his thinking and planning a countermove to his every move. I did not think at any time that while he was still alive he would pass on his powers to his daughter. I had not studied her, and I was not prepared for her utter lack of caution. Unlike her father, she has been brought up to take power for granted, and had no clear idea of its limitations. So she got you, and forced me to act before I was quite ready." "You almost lost me as a result. I faced the muzzle of a blaster twice." "I know," said Hummin, nodding. "And we might have lost you upperside, too, another accident I could not foresee." "But you haven't really answered my question. Why did you send me chasing all over the face of Trantor to escape from Demerzel, when you yourself were Demerzel?" "You told Cleon that psychohistory was a purely theoretical concept, a kind of mathematical game that made no practical sense. That might indeed have been so, but if I approached you officially, I was sure you would merely have maintained your belief. Yet I was attracted to the notion of psychohistory. I wondered whether it might not be, after all, just a game. You must understand that I didn't want merely to use you. I wanted a real and practical psychohistory. So I sent you, as you put it, chasing all over the face of Trantor, with the dreaded Demerzel close on your heels at all times. That, I felt, would concentrate your mind powerfully. It would make psychohistory something exciting, and much more than a mathematical game. You would try to work it out for the sincere idealist Hummin, where you would not for the imperial flunky Demerzel. Also you would get a glimpse of various sides of Trantor, and that too would be helpful. Certainly more helpful than living in an ivory tower on a far-off planet surrounded entirely by fellow mathematicians. Was I right? Have you made progress?" Selden said, "In psychohistory?" "Yes, I did, Hummin. I thought you knew." "How should I know?" "I told Dors." "But you hadn't told me." "Nevertheless, you tell me so now. That is good news." "Not entirely," said Selden. "I have made only the barest beginning. but it is a beginning. Is it the kind of beginning that can be explained to a non-mathematician? I think so. You see, Helen, from the start I have seen psychohistory as a science that depends on the interaction of 25 million worlds, each with an average population of 4,000 million. It's too much. There's no way of handling something that complex. If I was to succeed at all, if there was to be any way of finding a useful psychohistory, I would first have to find a simpler system. So I thought I would go back in time and deal with a single world, a world that was the only one occupied by humanity in the dim age before the colonization of the galaxy. In Mycogen, they spoke of an original world of Aurora, and in Dahl I heard word of an original world of Earth. I thought they might be the same world under different names, but they were sufficiently different in one key point at least to make that impossible. And it didn't matter. So little was known of either one, and that little so obscured by myth and legend, that there was no hope of making use of psychohistory in connection with them. He paused to sip at his cold juice, keeping his eyes firmly on Hammond's face. Hammond said, "Well, what then?" Meanwhile, Doors had told me something I call the hand-on-thigh story. It was of no innate significance, merely a humorous and entirely trivial tale. As a result, though, Doors mentioned the different sex mores on various worlds and in various sectors of Trantor. It occurred to me that she treated the different Trantorian sectors as though they were separate worlds. I thought idly that instead of 25 million different worlds, I had 25 million plus 800 to deal with. It seemed a trivial difference, so I forgot it and thought no more about it. But as I traveled from the Imperial sector to Streeling, to Mycogen, to Dahl, to Y, I observed for myself how different each was. The thought of Trantor, not as a world but as a complex of worlds, grew stronger, but still I didn't see the crucial point. It was only when I listened to Rochelle. You see, it was good that I was finally captured by Y, and it was good that Rochelle's rashness drove her into the grandiose schemes that she imparted to me. When I listened to Rochelle, as I said, she told me that all she wanted was Trantor and some immediately adjacent worlds. It was an empire in itself, she said, and dismissed the outer worlds as distant nothings. It was then that, in a moment, I saw what I must have been harboring in my hidden thoughts for a considerable time. On the one hand, Trantor possessed an extraordinarily complex social system, being a populous world made up of 800 smaller worlds. It was in itself a system complex enough to make psychohistory meaningful, and yet it was simple enough, compared to the empire as a whole, to make psychohistory perhaps practical. And the outer worlds, the 25 million of them, they were distant nothings. Of course, they affected Trantor and were affected by Trantor, but these were second-order effects. If I could make psychohistory work as a first approximation for Trantor alone, then the minor effects of the outer worlds could be added as later modifications. Do you see what I mean? I was searching for a single world on which to establish a practical science of psychohistory, and I was searching for it in the far past, when all the time the single world I wanted was under my feet now. Hammond said with obvious relief and pleasure, "Wonderful." "But it's all left to do, Hammond. I must study Trantor in sufficient detail. I must devise the necessary mathematics to deal with it. If I am lucky and live out a full lifetime, I may have the answers before I die. If not, my successors will have to follow me. Conceivably, the empire may have fallen and splintered before psychohistory becomes a useful technique. I will do everything I can to help you." "I know it," said Selden. You trust me, then, despite the fact I am Demerzel? Entirely. Absolutely. But I do so because you are not Demerzel.
But I am, insisted Hammond.
But you are not. Your persona as Demerzel is as far removed from the truth as is your persona as Hammond.
What do you mean?
Hammond's eyes grew wide, and he backed away slightly from Selden.
I mean that you probably chose the name Hammond out of a wry sense of what was fitting.
Hammond is a mispronunciation of human, isn't it?
Hammond made no response. He continued to stare at Selden.
And finally Selden said, Because you're not human, are you, Hammond Demerzel? You're a robot.
Doors.
Selden, Harry. It is customary to think of Harry Selden only in connection with psychohistory, to see him only as mathematics and social change personified. There is no doubt that he himself encouraged this, for at no time in his formal writings did he give any hint as to how he came to solve the various problems of psychohistory. His leaps of thought might have all been plucked from air, for all he tells us. Nor does he tell us of the blind alleys into which he crept, or the wrong turnings he may have made. As for his private life, it is a blank. Concerning his parents and siblings, we know a handful of factors, no more. His only son, Rach Selden, is known to have been adopted, but how that came about is not known. Concerning his wife, we only know that she existed. Clearly, Selden wanted to be a cipher, except where psychohistory was concerned. It is as though he felt, or wanted it to be felt, that he did not live. He merely psychohistorified. Encyclopedia Galactica. 91. Hammond sat calmly, not a muscle twitching, still looking at Harry Selden. And Selden, for his part, waited. It was Hammond, he thought, who should speak next. Hammond did, but said merely, A robot? Me? By robot, I presume you mean an artificial being such as the object you saw in the Sacratorium in Mycogen.
Not quite like that, said Selden. Not metal, not burnished, not a lifeless simulacrum.
Hammond said it without any evidence of amusement.
No, to be of artificial life is not necessarily to be made of metal. I speak of a robot indistinguishable from a human being in appearance.
If indistinguishable, Harry, then how do you distinguish?
Not by appearance.
Explain.
Hammond, in the course of my flight from yourself as Demerzel, I heard of two ancient worlds, as I told you, Aurora and Earth. Each seemed to be spoken of as a first world or an only world. In both cases, robots were spoken of, but with a difference.
Selden was staring thoughtfully at the man across the table, wondering if, in any way, he would give some sign that he was less than a man, or more. He said, Where Aurora was in question, one robot was spoken of as a renegade, a traitor, someone who deserted the cause. Where Earth was in question, one robot was spoken of as a hero, one who represented salvation. Was it too much to suppose that it was the same robot?
Was it? Murmured Hammond.
This is what I thought, Hammond. I thought that Earth and Aurora were two separate worlds coexisting in time. I don't know which one preceded the other. From the arrogance and the conscious sense of superiority of the Mycogenians, I might suppose that Aurora was the original world, and that they despised the Earthmen who derived from them, or who degenerated from them. On the other hand, Mother Ritta, who spoke to me of Earth, was convinced that Earth was the original home of humanity,
And certainly the tiny and isolated position of the Mycogenians in a whole galaxy of quadrillions of people who lacked the strange Mycogenian ethos might mean that Earth was indeed the original home, and that Aurora was the aberrant offshoot. I cannot tell, but I pass on to you my thinking so that you will understand my final conclusions. Hammond nodded. I see what you are doing. Please continue. The worlds were enemies. Mother Ritta certainly made it sound so. When I compare the Mycogenians, who seem to embody Aurora, and the Dalites, who seem to embody Earth, I imagine that Aurora, whether first or second, was nevertheless the one that was more advanced, the one that could produce more elaborate robots, even ones indistinguishable from human beings in appearance. Such a robot was designed and devised in Aurora then, but he was a renegade, so he deserted Aurora. To the Earth people, he was a hero, so he must have joined Earth. Why he did this, what his motives were, I can't say. Hammond said, Surely you mean why it did this, what its motives were? Perhaps, but with you sitting across from me, said Selden, I find it difficult to use the inanimate pronoun. Mother Ritta was convinced that the heroic robot, her heroic robot, still existed, that he would return when he was needed. It seemed to me that there was nothing impossible in the thought of an immortal robot, or at least one who was immortal, as long as the replacement of worn-out parts was not neglected. Even the brain? Asked Hammond. Even the brain. I don't really know anything about robots, but I imagine a new brain could be re-recorded from the old. And Mother Ritta hinted of strange mental powers. I thought, it must be so. I may in some ways be a romantic, but I am not so much a romantic as to think that one robot, by switching from one side to the other, can alter the course of history. A robot could not make Earth's victory sure, nor Aurora's defeat certain, unless there was something strange, something peculiar about the robot. Hammond said, Does it occur to you, Harry, that you are dealing with legends, legends that may have been distorted over the centuries and the millennia, even to the extent of building a veil of the supernatural over quite ordinary events? Can you make yourself believe in a robot that not only seems human, but that also lives forever and has mental powers? Are you not beginning to believe in the superhuman? I know very well what legends are, and I am not one to be taken in by them and made to believe in fairy tales. Still, when they are supported by certain odd events that I have seen, and even experienced myself, such as, Hammond, I met you and trusted you from the start. Yes, you helped me against those two hoodlums when you didn't need to, and that predisposed me in your favor, since I didn't realize at the time that they were your hirelings, doing what you had instructed them to do. But never mind that. No, said Hammond, a hint of amusement, finally, in his voice. I trusted you. I was easily convinced not to go home to Helicon and to make myself a wanderer over the face of Trentor. I believed everything you told me without question. I placed myself entirely in your hands. Looking back on it now, I see myself as not myself. I am not a person to be so easily led, yet I was. More than that, I did not even think it strange that I was behaving so far out of character. You know yourself best, Harry. It wasn't only me. How is it that Doris Venebile, a beautiful woman with a career of her own, should abandon that career in order to join me in my flight? How is it that she should risk her life to save mine, seeming to take on as a kind of holy duty the task of protecting me, and becoming single-minded in the process? Was it simply because you asked her to? I did ask her to, Harry. Yet she does not strike me as the kind of person to make such a radical changeover in her life merely because someone asks her to. Nor could I believe it was because she had fallen madly in love with me at first sight and could not help herself. I somehow wish she had, but she seems quite the mistress of her emotional self. More, I am now speaking to you frankly, than I myself am with respect to her. She is a wonderful woman, said Hammond. I don't blame you. Selden went on. How is it, moreover, that Sunmaster 14, a monster of arrogance, and one who leads a people who are themselves stiff-necked in their own conceit, should be willing to take in tribespeople like Dors and myself, and to treat us as well as the Mycogenians could and did? When we broke every rule, committed every sacrilege, how is it that you could still talk him into letting us go? How could you talk the Tisalvers with their petty prejudices into taking us in? How can you be at home everywhere in the world, be friends with everyone, influence each person, regardless of their individual peculiarities? For that matter, how do you manage to manipulate Cleon, too? And if he is viewed as malleable and easily molded, then how were you able to handle his father, who by all accounts was a rough and arbitrary tyrant? How could you do all this? Most of all, how is it that Mannix the Fourth of Y could spend decades building an army without peer, one trained to be proficient in every detail, and yet have it fall apart when his daughter tries to make use of it? How could you persuade them to play the renegade, all of them, as you have done? Hammond said, Might this mean no more than that I am a tactful person, used to dealing with people of different types, that I am in a position to have done favors for crucial people, and am in a position to do additional favors in the future? Nothing I have done, it might seem, requires the supernatural. Nothing you have done, not even the neutralization of the Wyan army. They did not wish to serve a woman. They must have known for years that any time Mannix laid down his powers, or any time he died, Rachel would be their mayor. Yet they showed no signs of discontent until you felt it necessary that they show it. Dors described you at one time as a very persuasive man, and so you are. More persuasive than any man could be. But you are not more persuasive than an immortal robot with strange mental powers might be. Well, Hammond? Hammond said, What is it you expect of me, Harry? Do you expect me to admit I'm a robot? That I only look like a human being? That I am immortal? That I am a mental marvel? Selden leaned toward Hammond as he sat there on the opposite side of the table. Yes, Hammond, I do. I expect you to tell me the truth, and I strongly suspect that what you have just outlined is the truth. You, Hammond, are the robot that Mother Ritta referred to as Da-Ni, friend of Ba-Li. You must admit it. You have no choice. 92. It was as though they were sitting in a tiny universe of their own. There, in the middle of Y, with the Yan army being disarmed by Imperial force, they sat quietly. There, in the midst of events that all of Trantor, and perhaps all the galaxy, was watching, there was this small bubble of utter isolation within which Selden and Hammond were playing their game of attack and defense. Selden trying hard to force a new reality. Hammond making no move to accept that new reality. Selden had no fear of interruption. He was certain that the bubble within which they sat had a boundary that could not be penetrated, that the robot's powers would keep all at a distance till the game was over. Hammond finally said, You are an ingenious fellow, Harry. But I fail to see why I must admit that I am a robot, and why I have no choice but to do so. Everything you say may be true as facts. Your own behavior, Dor's behavior, Sunmasters, Dissolvers, the Wyan Generals. All may have happened as you said, but that doesn't force your interpretation of the meaning of the events to be true. Surely everything that happened can have a natural explanation. You trusted me because you accepted what I said. Doris felt your safety to be important because she felt psychohistory to be crucial, herself being a historian. Sunmaster and Tisalver were beholden to me for favors you know nothing of. The Wyan generals resented being ruled by a woman, no more. Why must we flee to the supernatural? Selden said, "See here, Haman. Do you really believe the Empire to be falling, and do you really consider it important that it not be allowed to do so, with no move made to save it, or at the least cushion its fall?" "I really do." Somehow Selden knew this statement was sincere. "And you really want me to work out the details of psychohistory, and you feel that you yourself cannot do it?" "I lack the capability." "And you feel that only I can handle psychohistory, even if I sometimes doubt it myself?" "Yes." "And you must therefore feel that if you can possibly help me in any way, you must."
Second Foundation by Isaac Asimov. Copyright 1953 by Isaac Asimov. Second Foundation by Isaac Asimov. This book is divided into two parts, plus a prologue. The dedication reads, "To Marcia, John, and Stan." Prologue. The First Galactic Empire had endured for tens of thousands of years. It had included all the planets of the galaxy in a centralized rule, sometimes tyrannical, sometimes benevolent, always orderly. Human beings had forgotten that any other form of existence could be, all except Harry Selden. Harry Selden was the last great scientist of the First Empire. It was he who brought the science of psychohistory to its full development. Psychohistory was the quintessence of sociology. It was the science of human behavior reduced to mathematical equations. The individual human being is unpredictable, but the reactions of human mobs, Selden found, could be treated statistically. The larger the mob, the greater the accuracy that could be achieved. And the size of the human masses that Selden worked with was no less than the population of the galaxy, which in his time was numbered in the quintillions. It was Selden, then, who foresaw, against all common sense and popular belief, that the brilliant empire, which seemed so strong, was in a state of irredeemable decay and decline. He foresaw, or he solved his equations and interpreted its symbols, which amounts to the same thing, that left to itself, the galaxy would pass through a 30,000-year period of misery and anarchy before a unified government would rise once more. He set about to remedy the situation, to bring about a state of affairs that would restore peace and civilization in a single thousand of years. Carefully, he set up two colonies of scientists that he called foundations. With deliberate intention, he set them up at opposite ends of the galaxy. One foundation was set up in the full daylight of publicity. The existence of the other, the second foundation, was drowned in silence. In Foundation, Gnome 1951, and Foundation and Empire, Gnome 1952, are told the first three centuries of the history of the first foundation. It began as a small community of encyclopedists, lost in the emptiness of the outer periphery of the galaxy. Periodically, it faced a crisis in which the variables of human intercourse, of the social and economic currents of the time, constricted about it. Its freedom to move lay along only one certain line, and when it moved in that direction, a new horizon of development opened before it. All had been planned by Harry Selden, long dead now. The First Foundation, with its superior science, took over the barbarized planets that surrounded it. It faced the anarchic warlords that broke away from the dying empire and beat them. It faced the remnant of the empire itself under its last strong emperor and its last strong general and beat it. Then it faced something which Harry Selden could not foresee, the overwhelming power of a single human being, a mutant. The creature known as the Mule was born with the ability to mold men's emotions and to shape their minds. His bitterest opponents were made into his devoted servants. Armies could not, would not fight him. Before him, the first foundation fell, and Selden's schemes lay partly in ruins. There was left the mysterious second foundation, the goal of all searches. The mule must find it to make his conquest of the galaxy complete. The faithful of what was left of the first foundation must find it, for quite another reason. But where was it? That no one knew. This, then, is the story of the search for the second foundation. Part 1. Search by the Mule. Chapter 1. Two Men and the Mule. The Mule. It was after the fall of the first foundation that the constructive aspects of the Mule's regime took shape. After the definite breakup of the First Galactic Empire, it was he who first presented history with a unified volume of space truly imperial in scope. The earlier commercial empire of the fallen foundation had been diverse and loosely knit, despite the impalpable backing of the predictions of psychohistory. It was not to be compared with the tightly controlled Union of Worlds under the Mule, comprising as it did 1/10 the volume of the galaxy and 1/15 of its population, particularly during the era of the so-called search. Encyclopedia Galactica, footnote. All quotations from the Encyclopedia Galactica, here reproduced, are taken from the 116th edition, published in 1020 FE, by the Encyclopedia Galactica Publishing Company, Terminus, with permission of the publishers. There is much more that the Encyclopedia has to say on the subject of the Mule and his empire, but almost all of it is not germane to the issue at immediate hand, and most of it is considerably too dry for our purposes in any case. Mainly, the article concerns itself at this point with the economic conditions that led to the rise of the first citizen of the Union, the Mule's official title, and with the economic consequences thereof. If, at any rate, the writer of the article is mildly astonished at the colossal haste with which the Mule rose from nothing to vast dominion in 5 years, he conceals it. If he is further surprised at the sudden cessation of expansion in favor of a 5-year consolidation of territory, he hides the fact. We therefore abandon the encyclopedia and continue on our own path for our own purposes and take up the history of the great interregnum between the First and Second Galactic Empires at the end of that 5 years of consolidation. Politically, the Union is quiet. Economically, it is prosperous. Few would care to exchange the peace of the Mule's steady grip for the chaos that had preceded. On the worlds that 5 years previously had known the Foundation, there might be a nostalgic regret, but no more. The Foundation's leaders were dead, where useless, and converted, where useful. And of the converted, the most useful was Han Pritchard, now Lieutenant General. In the days of the Foundation, Han Pritchard had been a captain and a member of the underground democratic opposition. When the Foundation fell to the Mule without a fight, Pritchard fought the Mule, until, that is, he was converted. The conversion was not the ordinary one brought on by the power of superior reason. Han Pritchard knew that well enough. He had been changed because the Mule was a mutant, with mental powers quite capable of adjusting the conditions of ordinary humans to suit himself. But that satisfied him completely. That was as it should be. The very contentment with the conversion was a prime symptom of it. But Han Pritchard was no longer even curious about the matter. And now that he was returning from his 5th major expedition into the boundlessness of the galaxy outside the Union, it was with something approaching artless joy that the veteran spaceman and intelligence agent considered his approaching audience with the First Citizen. His hard face, gouged out of a dark, grainless wood that did not seem to be capable of smiling without cracking, didn't show it. But the outward indications were unnecessary. The Mule could see the emotions within, down to the smallest, much as an ordinary man could see the twitch of an eyebrow. Pritchard left his air car at the old Vice-Regal hangars and entered the palace grounds on foot, as was required. He walked 1 mile along the arrowed highway, which was empty and silent. Pritchard knew that over the square miles of palace grounds, there was not one guard, not one soldier, not one armed man. The Mule had need of no protection. The Mule was his own best, all-powerful protector. Pritchard's footsteps beat softly in his own ears as the palace reared its gleaming, incredibly light and incredibly strong metallic walls before him in the daring, overblown, near-hectic arches that characterized the architecture of the late empire. It brooded strongly over the empty grounds, over the crowded city on the horizon. Within the palace was that one man, by himself, on whose inhuman mental attributes depended the new aristocracy and the whole structure of the Union. The huge, smooth door swung massively open at the general's approach, and he entered. He stepped onto the wide, sweeping ramp that moved upward under him. He rose swiftly on the noiseless elevator. He stood before the small, plain door of the mule's own room in the highest glitter of the palace spires. It opened. Bail Chanis was young, and Bail Chanis was unconverted. That is, in plainer language, his emotional makeup had been unadjusted by the mule. It remained exactly as it had been formed by the original shape of its heredity and the subsequent modifications of his environment. And that satisfied him, too. At not quite 30, he was in marvelously good odor in the capital. He was handsome and quick-witted, therefore successful in society. He was intelligent and self-possessed, therefore successful with the mule. And he was thoroughly pleased at both successes. And now, for the first time, the mule had summoned him to personal audience. His legs carried him down the long, glittering highway that led tautly to the sponge aluminum spires that had been once the residence of the Viceroy of Kalgan, who ruled under the old emperors, and that had been later the residence of the independent princes of Kalgan, who ruled in their own name, and that was now the residence of the first citizen of the Union, who ruled over an empire of his own. Chanis hummed softly to himself. He did not doubt what this was all about. The second foundation, naturally. That all-embracing bogey, the mere consideration of which had thrown the mule back from his policy of limitless expansion into static caution. The official term was consolidation. Now, there were rumors. You couldn't stop rumors. The mule was to begin the offensive once more. The mule had discovered the whereabouts of the second foundation and would attack. The mule had come to an agreement with the second foundation and divided the galaxy. The mule had decided the second foundation did not exist and would take over all the galaxy. No use listing all the varieties one heard in the anterooms. It was not even the first time such rumors had circulated, but now they seemed to have more body in them. And all the free, expansive souls who thrived on war, military adventure, and political chaos, and withered in times of stability and stagnant peace, were joyful. Bail Chanis was one of these. He did not fear the mysterious Second Foundation. For that matter, he did not fear the mule, and boasted of it. Some, perhaps, who disapproved of one at once so young and so well off, waited darkly for the reckoning with the gay ladies' man who employed his wit openly at the expense of the mule's physical appearance and sequestered life. None dared join him, and few dared laugh. But when nothing happened to him, his reputation rose accordingly. Chanis was improvising words to the tune he was humming. Nonsense words with the recurrent refrain, "Second Foundation threatens the nation and all of creation." He was at the palace. The huge, smooth door swung massively open at his approach, and he entered. He stepped onto the wide, sweeping ramp that moved upward under him. He rose swiftly in the noiseless elevator. He stood before the small, plain door of the mule's own room, in the highest glitter of the palace spires. It opened. The man who had no name other than the mule, and no title other than first citizen, looked out through the one-way transparency of the wall to the light and lofty city on the horizon. In the darkening twilight, the stars were emerging, and not one but owed allegiance to him. He smiled with fleeting bitterness at the thought. The allegiance they owed was to a personality few had ever seen. He was not a man to look at, the mule, not a man to look at without derision. Not more than 120 pounds was stretched out into his 5'8" length. His limbs were bony stalks that jutted out of his scrawniness in graceless angularity, and his thin face was nearly drowned out in the prominence of a fleshy beak that thrust 3 inches outward. Only his eyes played false with the general farce that was the mule. In their softness, a strange softness for the galaxy's greatest conqueror, sadness was never entirely subdued. In the city was to be found all the gaiety of a luxurious capital on a luxurious world. He might have established his capital on the foundation, the strongest of his now conquered enemies, but it was far out on the very rim of the galaxy. Kalgan, more centrally located, with a long tradition as aristocracy's playground, suited him better, strategically. But in its traditional gaiety, enhanced by unheard-of prosperity, he found no peace. They feared him, and obeyed him, and perhaps even respected him, from a goodly distance. But who could look at him without contempt? Only those he had converted. And of what value was their artificial loyalty? It lacked flavor. He might have adopted titles, and enforced ritual and invented elaborations, but even that would have changed nothing. Better, or at least no worse, to be simply the first citizen, and to hide himself. There was a sudden surge of rebellion within him, strong and brutal. Not a portion of the galaxy must be denied him. For 5 years he had remained silent and buried here on Kalgan, because of the eternal, misty, space-ridden menace of the unseen, unheard, unknown Second Foundation. He was 32, not old, but he felt old. His body, whatever its mutant mental powers, was physically weak. Every star he could see and every star he couldn't see, it must all be his. Revenge on all, on a humanity of which he wasn't a part, on a galaxy in which he didn't fit. The cool overhead warning light flickered. He could follow the progress of a man who had entered the palace, and simultaneously, as though his mutant sense had been enhanced and sensitized in the lonely twilight, he felt the wash of emotional content touch the fibers of his brain. He recognized the identity without an effort. It was Pritcher, Captain Pritcher of the One-Time Foundation. The Captain Pritcher who had been ignored and passed over by the bureaucrats of that decaying government. The Captain Pritcher whose job as petty spy he had wiped out, and whom he had lifted from its slime. The Captain Pritcher whom he had made first colonel and then general, whose scope of activity he had made galaxy-wide. The now General Pritcher, who was, iron rebel though he began, completely loyal. And yet, with all that, not loyal because of benefits gained, not loyal out of gratitude, not loyal as a fair return, but loyal only through the artifice of conversion. The mule was conscious of that strong, unalterable surface layer of loyalty and love that colored every swirl and eddy of the emotionality of Han Pritcher, the layer he had himself implanted 5 years before. Far underneath, there were the original traces of stubborn individuality, of impatience of rule, idealism. But even he himself could scarcely detect them any longer. The door behind him opened, and he turned. The transparency of the wall faded to opacity, and the purple evening light gave way to the whitely blazing glow of atomic power. Han Pritcher took the seat indicated. There was neither bowing nor kneeling, nor the use of honorifics in private audiences with the mule. The mule was merely first citizen. He was addressed as Sir. You sat in his presence, and you could turn your back to him if it so happened that you did. To Han Pritcher, this was all evidence of the sure and confident power of the man, and he was warmly satisfied with it. The mule said, Your final report reached me yesterday. I can't deny that I find it somewhat depressing, Pritcher. The general's eyebrows closed upon each other. Yes, I imagine so. But I don't see to what other conclusion I could have come. There just isn't any Second Foundation, sir. And the mule considered, and then slowly shook his head, as he had done many a time before. There's the evidence of Ebling Miz. There is always the evidence of Ebling Miz. It was not a new story. Pritcher said it without qualification. Miz may have been the greatest psychologist of the Foundation, but he was a baby compared to Harry Seldon. At the time he was investigating Seldon's works, he was under the artificial stimulation of your own brain control. You may have pushed him too far. He might have been wrong. Sir, he must have been wrong. The mule sighed, his lugubrious face thrust forward on its thin stalk of a neck. If he had only lived another minute, he was on the point of telling me where the Second Foundation was. He knew, I'm telling you. I need not have retreated. I need not have waited and waited. So much time lost. 5 years gone for nothing. Pritchard could not have been censorious over the weak longing of his ruler. His controlled mental makeup forbade that. He was disturbed instead, vaguely uneasy. He said, "But what alternative explanation can there possibly be, sir? 5 times I've gone out. You yourself have plotted the routes, and I've left no asteroid unturned. It was 300 years ago that Harry Seldon of the old empire supposedly established 2 foundations to act as nuclei of a new empire to replace the dying old one. 100 years after Seldon, the first foundation, the one we know so well, was known through all the periphery. 150 years after Seldon, at the time of the last battle with the old empire, it was known throughout the galaxy. And now it's 300 years. And where should this mysterious second be? In no eddy of the galactic stream has it been heard of. Ebling Miss said it kept itself secret. Only secrecy can turn its weakness to strength. Secrecy as deep as this is past possibility, without non-existence as well. The mule looked up, large eyes sharp and wary. No, it does exist. A bony finger pointed sharply. There is going to be a slight change in tactics. Pritchard frowned. You plan to leave yourself? I would scarcely advise it. No, of course not. You will have to go out once again, one last time, but with another in joint command. There was a silence, and Pritchard's voice was hard. Who, sir? There's a young man here in Calgan, Bale Channis. I've never heard of him, sir. No, I imagine not. But he's got an agile mind, he's ambitious, and he's not converted. Pritchard's long jaw trembled for a bare instant. I fail to see the advantage in that. There is one, Pritchard. You're a resourceful and experienced man. You have given me good service. But you are converted. Your motivation is simply an enforced and helpless loyalty to myself. When you lost your native motivations, you lost something, some subtle drive that I cannot possibly replace. I don't feel that, sir, said Pritchard grimly. I recall myself quite well as I was in the old days when I was an enemy of yours. I feel none the inferior. Naturally not, and the mule's mouth twitched into a smile. Your judgment in this matter is scarcely objective. This Channis now is ambitious, for himself. He is completely trustworthy, out of no loyalty but to himself. He knows that it is on my coattails that he rides, and he would do anything to increase my power, that the ride might be long and far, and that the destination might be glorious. If he goes with you, there is just that added push behind his seeking, that push for himself. Then, said Pritchard, still insistent, why not remove my own conversion, if you think that will improve me? I can scarcely be mistrusted now. That never, Pritchard. While you are within arm's reach, or blaster reach, of myself, you will remain firmly held in conversion. If I were to release you this minute, I would be dead the next. The general's nostrils flared. I am hurt that you should think so. I don't mean to hurt you, but it is impossible for you to realize what your feelings would be if free to form themselves along the lines of your natural motivation. The human mind resents control. The ordinary human hypnotist cannot hypnotize a person against his will for that reason. I can, because I'm not a hypnotist. And believe me, Pritchard, the resentment that you cannot show and do not even know you possess is something I wouldn't want to face. Pritchard's head bowed. Futility wrenched him and left him gray and haggard inside. He said with an effort, But how can you trust this man? I mean, completely, as you can trust me in my conversion. Well, I suppose I can't entirely. That is why you must go with him. You see, Pritchard, and the mule buried himself in the large armchair against the soft back of which he looked like an angularly animated toothpick. If he should stumble on the second foundation, if it should occur to him that arrangement with them might be more profitable than with me, you understand? A profoundly satisfied light blazed in Pritchard's eyes. That is better, sir. Exactly. But remember, he must have a free rein as far as possible. Certainly. And, Pritcher. The young man is handsome, pleasant, and extremely charming. Don't let him fool you. He's a dangerous and unscrupulous character. Don't get in his way.